Hello, the North Carolina Reading Service is presenting Indie Week. For our blind and impaired listeners, John Federson is reading this week's edition that's dated December 28th of 2023. And we'll fade down and get ourselves started with this issue. And Christmas is over, officially, the holiday, that is, but not the season. And what about a bit of Disney magic, if you can call it that? This is, as Oscar Wilde wrote in 1891, life imitates art far more than art imitates life. Very witty, Wilde. Disney, no stranger to imitating art, announced its Story Living brand in 2022. It includes, quote, Disney-branded, master-planned residential communities designed to be the perfect setting for Disney fans to write the next exciting chapter in their lives, says the chair of Disney Experiences in a video about Story Living. The venture will allow the company to, quote, bring the magic of Disney to places you may never have expected. The first of those places was in the Coachella Valley of California, where Story Living home sales are expected to begin in 2024. The second unexpected place to be hit with an overdose of Disney magic will be Pittsburgh, where 4,000 Story Living units are expected to come onto the market by 2027, according to a Disney press release this week. And Disney says the community will come to life on 1,500 acres in the heart of North Carolina's picturesque Chatham County, including single-family and multifamily homes with some home sites specifically designed for adults 55 and over. The Asteria community will be part of a larger, award-winning Chatham Park master-planned community by Preston Development Company, co-founded by Julian, Bubba, Rawl, and Tim Smith, says Disney. The venture into real estate isn't new for Disney. Epcot, a theme park of Disney World, was originally conceived as a planned community of tomorrow, and the company has launched various other projects in Florida. This kind of bold venture has also been imagined by screenwriters. In HBO's series Succession, the fictional world's media megacorporation announces a product called Living Plus, a luxury assisted living real estate development. Logan Roy, Succession's fictional CEO, had this to say, "What this new product offers is community, enriched with the integrated interactions with the cherished family of movie and TV characters. I'm convinced that the real estate brand can bring the cruise ship experience to dry land." Disney has not yet released many solid details about the Pittsburgh development, but if the images on the storytelling website are anything to go by, the plan is heavily reliant on intergenerational groups of racially diverse individuals with great skin, constantly celebrating nondescript occasions by getting boozy in between yoga classes. Planned amenities include, quote, a wellness and recreation center, restaurant, sport courts, swimming pools, community garden, and plenty of outdoor space for lawn games, events, and fire pits, says the release. Some of the experiences under consideration include storytelling dinners inspired by Disney tales, lessons with Disney artists, and family fun days with Disney-themed activities. It's not clear how much your dream home may cost in the Pittsburgh development, but the website for the development in Coachella Valley, where real estate is notoriously pricey, lists several tiers of homes that will be available soon on the West Coast. The lowest tier, the cottage collection has, quote, prices anticipated to start from the upper 1 millions. The grand collection starts at a low 2 millions. The estate collection does not yet have prices listed. Don't worry. Each home, no matter how few millions it costs, will, quote, meet Disney standards of excellence. The California development also has plans to include an equestrian-themed dog park, a bay full of the clearest turquoise waters with crystal lagoons, our technology, and the option to pay as little as $11,000 annually, plus a one-time $20,000 initiation fee and $1,000 annual food and drink minimum, to be a member of the Artisan Club, anchored by a real-life version of the animated home in The Incredibles 2. The company hasn't announced how much a similar membership may cost in Pittsburgh development, but the website promises there will be a club to feature enrichment programming only Disney can deliver. A Succession character says, "Why are you doing this, bull blank?" Challenging this fictional Living Plus concept. It's land cruises. Hey, you know how crappy and heartbreaking it is being locked up on a cruise? How about that? But you also get to stay in the same freaking place the whole time? Whew. Updates to follow. The next article has material originally announced or reported upon by WRAL News. New test results from North Carolina State Building show PCB levels up to 38 times higher than EPA standards. This concerns Poe Hall at NC State. 5 rooms are contaminated with these PCBs at these levels. According to sampling results obtained by Newsline this week under public records law. The results are here, and Newsline has annotated them to explain what they mean. University officials last month temporarily closed the 7-story building after initial tests showed the presence of PCBs, a probable carcinogen, in various building materials, including in several air handling units. Poe Hall houses the College of Education and the Department of Psychology. All right, WRAL first reported on the building's closure. Several people who worked in the building had reported black liquid was dripping onto their desks. An employee filed a complaint with the State Department of Labor in September, WRAL reported, but the university did not close the building until November the 17th. Here is a list of the affected rooms and the levels of Irochlor-1262, a type of PCB, detected. In 2 cases, a second type of PCB also was detected, Irochlor-1254, which is more toxic. Sampling was conducted in October and November. An important number to remember, 50 parts per million or greater for insulation and other solid materials, 50 parts per million. That's the level at which the materials must be removed, according to the Federal Toxic Substance Control Act. For the swipe samples, the key figure is 10 parts per billion in a 4-inch by 4-inch square. This threshold applies to non-porous surfaces like metal tables, in high occupancy areas like classrooms and offices. Now, next in this article, it's not too long, I'm going to read some numbers to you. If you just remember, 50 parts per million or more means you've got to remove it. So here are the particular rooms and some of the samples offered. I won't read them all. 11 faculty offices. Room 520E, bulk samples, 800 ppm and 450 ppm. Door gasket, 800. Duct insulation, 900. Fiber, 8.45 ppm. Remember, 50 is the magic number. Room 417, instructional computing facility. Insulation, 600. Fiber, 100. Swipe samples. This is where you need 10 parts, 8.5 and 6.2. Room 310P, faculty office, insulation dust, 200 and 170. Swipe sample, 1.3. Fifth floor, woman's bathroom, dust, 1,900 parts per million. Room 100 is an air handling unit, 59 ppm. Now, the second type of PCB was detected at 25. However, this is a more toxic type and can harm the kidneys and sperm motility at lower levels. And there's only a couple more. A faculty office, room 730. Swipe sample, 12 parts per billion, plus of the 1, plus 2.3 of arachlor-1254. That's the more toxic. It also had PCB-contaminated materials in the insulation, but at safe levels, if any level can be called safe. Another faculty office, about the same. Other air handling units without rooms, designated rooms, 52 to 89 parts per million, and the other one, 750. All right, there's the numbers. PCBs can be absorbed through skin, water, air, and food, especially fish. EPA and FDA have set maximum contaminant levels for water and food, while OSHA governs exposure in the workplace, primarily in the air. The level of risk depends not only on the amount of exposure, but the length of time. A person who worked in a contaminated office 40 hours a week for 10 years would be at greater risk than someone who visited that same office once a week for a half hour. Blood tests can indicate levels of exposure, according to federal health officials, but might not predict the effects. Well, the long-term effects include cancer of the liver and biliary tract, like gallbladder, pancreas, bile ducts. Exposure can also suppress the immune system, according to National Institutes of Health, as well as cause thyroid and reproductive disorders. Women are at high risk of giving birth to infants of low birth weight. Short-term issues include acne or other skin lesions, high blood pressure, or high cholesterol. In a statement issued in late November, Warwick Arden, Executive Vice Chancellor and Provost, and Carlos Maimone, Executive Vice Chancellor, wrote, "The university is hiring an outside consultant, quote, to conduct more comprehensive environmental testing to help us better understand the environment in the building. Until we have this information, we cannot provide definitive guidance about what, if any, remediation or cleaning is needed, or whether the findings are cause for concern from a health perspective. Please know that as soon as we have additional context and guidance, we will share it." From 1929 to 1977, Monsanto manufactured PCBs for use as coolants and insulating fluids for electrical equipment and machinery like transformers, capacitors, even ballasts in fluorescent lights. EPA banned the manufacture of PCBs in 1979. However, because they don't break down in the environment, contamination can still be found in buildings that were constructed or renovated between 1950 and 1979. Poe Hall was built in 1971. Because of their widespread use, PCBs could be present in 60% of building stock, according to Environmental Health and Engineering. This includes schools. The New York Times reported this week a jury in Washington State determined that Monsanto should pay $850 million to former students and parent volunteers who said they had been exposed to PCBs at the Sky Valley Education Center and become sick. Monsanto is appealing the verdict and what the company calls, in a prepared statement, constitutionally excessive damages. PCBs are found at many Superfund sites nationwide, including the former Ward Transformer site near the Raleigh-Durham International Airport. Contamination from that site entered Lake Crabtree, Crabtree Creek, and Briar Creek, prompting state officials to issue a fish consumption advisory. Next, a first-hand report from the correspondent named Elam Lee. And here's what IndyWeek has to say about Elam Lee. She's a Georgia peach who took a detour in New England and came back to her roots in the South this past year. Her least in progress, most finished project is her children's book, Needle and the Too Big World. And it gives a Twitter place you could follow Miss Lee. And by the way, if you went to IndyWeek.com and looked at this article, you could see the links described that I just mentioned. Well, this is about farm church. And the title, I Met Jesus on a Farm. Farm church operates on a precious plot of land around the corner from my house. I always pass it on walks. Their front lawn is where I got my We Support Fair Wages for City Workers sign. And their Instagram advertises mutual aid opportunities before pleading congregation numbers. All an indication that something radical might be happening. I follow my curiosity. Sunday service resembles a discussion group at a liberal arts college more than a pulpit-led sermon. Handouts circulate from a book on food inequity, and we dismantle the welfare queen myth together. Read next to a passage from the Bible, the idea arises that scripture is not always a moral, but can often be a mirror. We remember Matthew as an anti-imperialist author to inform our view of the parable of the talents. The slaves in the story parallel those submissive under capitalism. The master would reap where he did not sow, punitive and ever demanding. The slave who could not earn more than he was given was thrown to a place with weeping and gnashing of teeth. That transitions seamlessly into a question for the group. We are asked where there is a weeping and gnashing of teeth today, and to utter aloud suffering in the world that needs to be held, we would carry it together. A core belief Farm Church operates around is that calling for justice and liberation within one community is a holy act. The gathered community for each Wednesday and Sunday is non-traditional. It carves out an alternative space to the classic steepled chapels, the places that ask themselves, where are the young people? Assumption is that the youth are not spiritually concerned. Farm Church disagrees, simply positing that young people don't like to conform. Tradition for tradition's sake is always asking for some degree of conformity. I grew up Southern Baptist in the Bible Belt of deep South Georgia. We sat obediently in the congregation and learned there was something inherently wrong with us for being gay, that women should submit to the male leaders of the household, and that CNN was the communist news network. Imagine my surprise sitting at Farm Church reflecting on Matthew 25, 14 through 30, and hearing people call it a denunciation of capitalism. The parable of the talents was taught to me as a warning to heed that God had entrusted me with a life, and it was a privilege and my duty to drive it into the ground and make it worth it, or else there would be hell to pay, literally. All my hometown friends left the church as soon as they could. But I held on, imagining something like Farm Church was possible. My renouncing of the organized religion I grew up with was held sacred by my own view of Jesus, full of radical care, righteous anger, and deeply anti-capitalist. But the question in today's world remains, can a church be anti-capitalist? Every Sunday morning at Farm Church is divided between farming and gathering. Kristen Summerfield acts as lead gardener first and pastoral leader second. She tells us what the garden needs today, how to prevent microbes in the dirt from getting bleached by the sun, how to encourage sustainable long-term farming by continually topping off the rows, and she shows us a fancy stake-filled device called a broad fork. We go row by row, weeding and thinning turnips, beets, carrots, and lettuce. All of this food will go to the community. We're shown how to thin the sproutlings, a rather callous-seeming measure of ripping up swaths of potential plants. This way, each vegetable will have space to grow. Kristen acknowledges the emotional distress that can come with having to pick what to leave and what to take, and this comforts me, as does the little bucket that appears where we can save all the sprouts for a tasty microgreen snack. Kneeling in the dirt, I strike up a conversation with a guy in his 30s who started his career in bioethics and has come around to a passion for food security. I make a new friend in an older man who grew up in the 1950s, drove from Alaska to the tip of Chile when Pinochet was in power. A man stands to the side and plays a fiddle as we garden. As it turns 11, folks hit a natural stopping point and complete the tasks for the day. We gather around the benches, and a little girl in overalls plays in a pile of dirt, shovel and bucket in hand, as if she's making sandcastles at the beach. The congregants sing a chorus from a song in a bonfire style. One man plays a guitar and sings the loudest. The Batya Levine lyrics are written in Sharpie on a piece of cardboard. May I be empty and open to receive the light. May I be empty and open to receive. May I be full and open to receive the light. May I be full and open to receive. Kristen emphasizes that what makes Farm Church successful in its mission is hyper-locality. They're not seeking to be a mega-church, and their organizational structure is horizontal. Kristen's boss is a council of church and community members. The church's original founders chose Durham for its unique community with an already active scene addressing food insecurity. Farm Church has simply plugged itself in with partners already working toward the same goal. As it grows, Farm Church is constantly asking, what are the needs of the gathered community? What are the needs of the community we serve? That means a Wednesday night pesto-making party spent in a kitchen, creating something out of all the basil the church rescued before the frost. We measure oil by the cup, fill many containers of pesto to donate to Feed Durham for the nonprofit Thanksgiving Meal Initiative. Nohemi, a member of Farm Church, says a big draw of the community was the space for 20 to 30-year-olds to gather. That and helping families who are food insecure, a hands-on alternative to the usual act of simply donating money to removed organizations. As a member of the Latino community, she says, it has been illuminating to realize how much of Durham's food insecure population looks and speaks like her. Farm Church, while mainly white, presents an interesting path of advocacy. Noemi calls them real allies. When I sit down and talk with Kristen on Monday, we are on similar pages of having arrived in the real world, ready to build the reality we wished for, only to be pleasantly surprised by the fulfillment already waiting. Farm Church is her first job out of seminary, and seminary itself was a path change from the corporate food production world she was slated for. During what she calls a breath of hesitation, she took a year after college to do service with the Presbyterian Church and fell in love with the spirituality of organic produce farming. I find myself relating to her imaginative questioning of the status quo. I say, "You're a manic pixie dream, Church." Kirsten laughs. Honestly, there could be no better compliment. All right, next, directly from Durham Municipal Government, how it gets hype for municipal government business. First-time viewers of Durham's city council meetings may find their jaws on the floor when they see the epic introduction video that calls Bull City's sessions to order. When the clock strikes the hour, the screens behind the council members flash the colors of Durham's flag. A lyricless yet robust beat begins to roll in a clip of Mayor Leonardo Williams, suited up and smiling and setting his hands in Angela Merkel's triangle of power gesture, appears, superimposed over Durham's main street skyline. After Williams, the rest of the council members each get their own moment, striking poses over shots of the Bull City. Mark Anthony Middleton and Nate Baker cross their arms. Javiera Caballero and Adriana Freeman put a hand or two, respectively, on their hips. Carl Rist tosses a baseball from hand to hand in a slow arc. Just as he catches it, the video cuts to an exterior shot of City Hall. The flag flashes back across the screen, and it's time for the council to get to the people's work. In just about 24 seconds, the video has called the meeting to order, introduced residents to their council members, and maybe, just maybe, gotten viewers a bit more excited about sitting through municipal government meeting. It's a piece of Durham politics and culture that only exists because the city's communications department had a grand vision. Nathan Ritterhouse, the media production specialist for the city government, says, "It's a great way for us to educate residents on who the council members are, what districts they represent." Rittenhouse was originally looking just to redo some of the graphics of the council meetings, so he watched a lot of council meetings from other cities, New York, Atlanta, Seattle, Minneapolis, for inspiration. Los Angeles, in particular, had an introduction that stood out to him. He pitched the idea to his department, and the first iteration of that video premiered in the council meeting in March of 2019, to the delight of nearly everyone. Then Councilmember Charlie Reese said, over the cheers of the audience and laughter of his peers, "I did not vote for that." But he still seemed to enjoy it. The city attorney said she thought it was like the opening of Parks and Rec, and that kind of hurt my feelings, said then Mayor Steve Shule, referencing a sitcom centered around the dysfunction of a city hall. Rittenhouse says that while some council members are initially shy on camera, they seem to really enjoy the final product, seeing themselves posing to stock music that Rittenhouse describes as J. Dilla meets Rocky. Like Durham, he says, it's got some soul. Most people don't come from a media background, so everyone's silly and everyone feels apprehensive, he says. He shoots a few different options of the council member posing in front of a green screen, lets the member pick out the one they like best. First term council member Carl Rist, who made his video debut this month, is a fan of such a simple way to connect people to their government. "There are a lot of hard decisions the council makes," he says, "and no politician, of course, wants to be seen as having too much fun when there are too many serious issues they work for in the city." But he hopes the video helps residents know a little bit about their elected representatives beyond just a placard on the dais. He admits, "At first, to be honest, I thought it was kind of a little bit silly." But he fully committed to the process, and by tossing a baseball, the first ever prop in a Durham Council intro video. He's raised the bar for future council members and their digital likenesses. Rittenhouse hopes the video, only about 23 seconds at the beginning of an often hours-long slog through municipal government business, helps to remind viewers of the great experiment of American government. Well, the feature-length article here, originally written on the 21st, just last week, How Morrisville Became a Capital of United States Cricket, written by Kunwar Kuldun Said. It's a long article, and they don't have that many other things to read, and so if you like cricket, enjoy this article. Around 7 p.m. in a cool October evening, Babar Baig is standing at one end of Church Street Park, staring into one of the three screens in front of him as he live streams the final bout of a tournament between two top-ranked teams. He said, "There are thousands of people who watch this live on YouTube, 12,000 to be exact, plus several hundred watching the contest in person." The batter is in his position as a fastball comes down the line. The batter swings and misses the swirling, dipping ball. He needs to hit the next one or his shot is over. He swings harder and connects this time, and the ball goes sailing outside the park. It was World Series season, but it wasn't baseball. People were gathered to watch here in Morrisville. It was cricket. And Church Street Park has become a U.S. and global hub for the sport. Baig says, "When I first started making cricket videos in the area and uploading them on YouTube a couple of decades ago, there were no grounds in Morrisville, and we used to play on the streets and parking lots, similar to gully cricket in Pakistan." Baig says he was born in the United Arab Emirates to Pakistani parents and moved to North Carolina back in 2000. Baig, 42, is the production manager for the Triangle Cricket League, TCL. Previously served as the league president. That league has been around since 2009 and moved to Church Street Park in 2013 after locals of Indian subcontinent heritage, who now constitute almost half the suburb's 30,000 residents, pushed for its creation. The game is played on a pitch with two teams of 11 players who take turns batting and fielding. The bat is wider and flatter than a baseball bat, and while the ball is similar in circumference and weight to a baseball, it's made of leather and has a seam of string running through the middle. The TCL, like other leagues, also has a separate hard tennis ball competition, which uses a much lighter ball. Batters and the catcher, called a wicketkeeper, wear gloves, but outfielders aren't allowed to. They field barehanded. The batters also wear leg pads and grilled helmets. They can score runs by hitting the ball out of the boundary or by running between two sets of three wickets placed at either end of this 22-yard pitch. The bowler, what baseball fans might call a pitcher, makes six deliveries in an over and wants to minimize the number of runs the other team scores in each. A bowler can dismiss a batter by hitting the wickets or if a fielder catches the ball. Once 10 batters are dismissed, the inning ends, even if not all allotted overs have been bowled. These are high-scoring affairs. The average score per inning in the most popular version of cricket, 20-over or T20, is a little more than 150 runs. In the last decade, Morrisville has made it onto the world cricket map, and Church Street is a place where top cricketers come to make a name for themselves. The TCL now has over 600 official teams and more than 3,000 registered players. And in 2021, USA Cricket launched Mirror League Cricket. Excuse me. Minor League Cricket. That's a group of 26 teams that includes the Morrisville Raptors. The Raptors finished second in the Southern Division in the first two seasons of this league. There is also now a junior championship with five age categories, beginning at under 11 years of age. Baig says, when I first came here, we had to go to other states to play any competitive cricket. Now people from all over North Carolina and America are coming here to play the game. The popularity of cricket is growing across America. The number of people who regularly watch cricket increased from 30,000 in 2006 to 24 million as of last year. While the sport is still mostly played by immigrants from the subcontinent or the Caribbean, there is at least one prominent exception in Morrisville. Mark Stolman, who plays for the TCL's Chicky Chicky Boom Boom, grew up playing baseball. His interest in cricket grew with its rise at Church Street Park. In the first few years, Stolman used to just watch the game and ask about the rules while chatting with fans. He started playing 6 years ago, and before an arm injury reduced his game time, the 64-year-old was a regular feature in the league's leather and hard tennis ball competitions. He said, I can no longer hit a six over long on or long off, but I can hit behind the wicket. I quite enjoy the reverse sweep. He referred to the cricket shot that requires quick, unorthodox footwork, often catching the bowler unaware. Stolman watches the Indian Premier League every season and is a big fan of Indian superstar and former World Cup winning captain Mahendra Singh Dhoni, who has retired from international play but still plays in the Indian Premier League. Being an MS myself, I've been rooting for the old guy, he added with a grin. Stolman, who was wearing a Morrisville Raptors jersey, also happens to be the former mayor of Morrisville, under whom the town council approved that pitch at Church Street Park. He says, the city was looking to add four fields for baseball and softball. If you were a serious baseball player as a kid, you would go to a bigger town, Cary or West Raleigh, to get really good competitive baseball. So baseball was falling out a bit here. Cricket, though, was taking off at the time. The town decided to slightly increase the size to make it a multi-purpose field where soccer, volleyball, softball, and other games could be played. In the middle of it, the town designated a cricket pitch. 2 years later, the International Cricket Council, ICC, the official governing body of the sport, visited Church Street Park to evaluate the field's potential for international contests. West Indies cricket cricket legend Alvin Kalicharan, who now coaches young cricketers in Morrisville, was instrumental in bringing these officials to see what North Carolina had to offer. While the United States has been an ICC associate member, since back in 1965 it has only become visible on the international cricket stage in recent years. Central Broward Park in Lauderhill, Florida, has hosted international matches featuring top-tier teams like New Zealand, Sri Lanka, West Indies, and India since 2010. But Church Street Park's initial bid faced a stumbling block. Stolman recalled, the pitch was garbage. For starters, the soil did not have the right composition for a cricket pitch and needed clay from another part of the country. The sod had to be brought in line with international standards. There was a lot of work put in on the pitch to get international recognition. Indiana clay was brought in along with world-renowned pitch curator David Agnew from Australia to oversee the construction. The bid paid off and Morrisville was picked to host the 2018 regional qualifier for the ICC World Cup. But days before the matches were scheduled to start, Hurricane Florence hit, dumping 20 inches of rain on Morrisville. The entire field was flooded, and volunteers affiliated with TCL worked day and night to ensure the games went ahead as planned from September the 20th, which formally put Church Street Park and Morrisville on the world cricket map. Hosting international contests gave the TCL a major boost, and the growing number of residents from the region began taking up cricket. The league has now four formats, a 40-over called the Premier League, a 20-over league known as T20, a 10-over, and a hard tennis ball format. There are three tournaments each year across the formats in spring, summer, and fall. And TCL President Vinod Kasragunda, as he gave a church tour of Church Street Park, says, "We also have a winter tournament if the temperature stays above 40. That's for the crazy cricket enthusiasts who want to play even in the winter." The growing enthusiasm for the sport has meant fast expansion. Right across the street from the main ground is Shiloh Park, where coaches train aspiring cricketers. In addition to Kalacharan, other Caribbean cricketers have moved to Morrisville to coach young kids and participate in minor cricket league. Among these is Ryan Wiggins, who plays for the Raptors and coaches school-age players. Wiggins has also played in the Caribbean Premier League, a top-tier franchise league hosted by the West Indies. Wiggins said, "Morrisville is on the right path as far as cricket is concerned. We just need to keep working on the kids and help them grow." Wiggins is holding a session with fellow West Indian Andre Dwyer, whose coaching pedigree includes coaching global superstar Andre Russell when he was first starting off at Clarendon College in Jamaica. Dwyer says, "I produced a lot of national players back home. My ultimate goal here is to produce national players for the U.S. team." Both Dwyer and Wiggins believe that cricket is poised to take off in the United States, thanks largely to the launch of Major League Cricket, that's MLC, launched just this year, which features many cricketing superstars. The league was founded following a $120 million investment from big names in the tech and media industries, including Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, Grand Prairie Stadium in Texas, and Church Street Park jointly hosted the inaugural season, and seven of the 19 matches took place in Morrisville, which can hold up to 3,500 fans. The opening season featured six teams: San Francisco Unicorns, the Washington Freedom, Seattle Orcas, MI New York, Los Angeles Knight Riders, and the Texas Super Kings. The last four are affiliated with the Indian Premier League franchises. Over 70,000 spectators turned up for the games in those two cities, while the live coverage was broadcast in 87 countries, generating a total revenue of $8 million for the inaugural season of the league. Wiggins says the MLC is absolutely on point. It is at par with franchise tournaments of international recognition around the world. The games in Morrisville featured global superstars and served some nail-biting contests. The MI New York versus Seattle Orcas game yielded almost 400 runs between the two sides, with South Africa's power hitter Heinrich Klassen scoring a mammoth 110 runs off a mere 44 balls. Klassen continued his all-out attacking display during the World Cup in India, where South Africa were one of the four semifinalists. Lance Brown, who was hired for the maintenance of the pitch at Church Street Park, first heard of cricket during his job interview. He says, "My first 3 days on the job, I was like, wow, I can't believe the amount of work that goes into maintaining the field." He says as he sat on a roller, which he was moving up and down the pitch. But the atmosphere and festivity of cricket captivated him. It was like the other American sports in terms of competitiveness. The Major League game drew capacity crowds, and for young fans like 11-year-old Harshvardhan, it was a chance to see international superstars in action. The sixth grader is a student of Dwyer and Wiggins and watched all the Major League games. He can rattle off stats, particularly when it comes to his favorite cricketers, Heinrich Klassen and Trent Boult. The latter, from New Zealand, took the most wickets in the league this year. Recounts Vardhan, he got 22 wickets in seven matches in the MLC. Vardhan started playing leather ball cricket 2 years ago. Like many kids of Indian heritage, his parents introduced him to the game at an early age. His father not only was an avid watcher, but also played, and now Vardhan competes in the minor league junior. He has lofty ambitions for the sport. He said, "My goal is to score 1,000 runs in the junior league. I want to play in the MLC at least, and for the USA. A number of young TCL players have already graduated to the major leagues, including Sanjay Stanley, who has been the vice captain of the national under-19 team, along with Abraham Borisetti, Aditya Gupta, and Rohan Fladke. The women's league has done even better, with Bhumika Badraju and Geetika Kodali playing for the U.S. women's national team. Kodali, a 19-year-old all-rounder and former captain of the national under-19s, began playing cricket at the age of 11 in California, but moved to North Carolina in 2019 to take the next step in her career. "This was the main reason for my move," she said. "It has helped me build my skills through training programs and coaching sessions offered on Church Street." She cites the youth training offered in Morrisville and the fact it draws teams from all of the United States, and the fact that TCL offers separate competitions for young women, saying, "With the increased diversity in the United States, where cricket is more popular in certain immigrant communities, more girls from those backgrounds are taking up the sport." Still, a lot more can be done to promote cricket, she said, such as reserving grounds for youth cricket, launching more youth training programs, and introducing cricket in schools. Kodali believes that while traditional American sports, especially baseball, remain popular in the region, cricket is fast catching up. Quote, "Cricket is widely followed. If introduced into schools with good program structure, it will appeal to a diverse population." Now, cricket will get another big boost in the coming year when the United States co-hosts the T20 World Cup with the West Indies. When the ICC first announced the host in 2021, there were concerns about USA Cricket's viability, ranging from a financial crunch — the organization is reportedly $650,000 in debt and in a funding dispute with the ICC — to a lack of facilities. But ICC confirmed in July that the United States was on deck, and in September the council announced the three venues where they would take place: Central Broward in Florida, Grand Prairie in Texas, and Eisenhower Park in New York. Not being named a World Cup venue was a major disappointment for Morrisville, but TCL officials acknowledge why Church Street did not get the final nod. While the field and pitch are undoubtedly of a global standing, the same cannot be said of the infrastructure around them. For one, there are no media facilities to properly broadcast international contests. Big, the production manager we saw at the beginning of this article, "I had to learn camera work on my own and have taught the others the same way as well. Even the camera we use for our live stream on YouTube is placed at an angle and not right in front of the pitch as it should be. Even more critically, there aren't dressing rooms or even practice pitches. When the MLC teams came to play here, they couldn't practice on the ground and had to play straight away," said Katragunta. "The only practice they had was in grounds in other parts of the area." Stolman concedes where they fall short. "We don't have 30,000 seats here, nor does it look as big and dramatic on TV as other venues. However, I will plead like anything to get a few practice matches played here before the World Cup." Eisenhower Park also lacked the facilities, but a 34,000-seat stadium is under construction. Grand Prairie and Broward are also undergoing major development ahead of the World Cup. "They could have done the same here," said a TCL executive committee member. "We already have much infrastructure in place and a world-class field." Proximity to cricket fans of Indian subcontinent heritage may also have tilted it to New York, Miami, and Dallas. But North Carolina fans hope the World Cup is just the first opportunity to show that the U.S. is a player on the international cricket stage. The Los Angeles Olympics, coming up in 2028, will also be the first to include cricket. Last year, Major League Cricket announced it was making a $110 million investment in 8 cricket venues across the U.S., including Church Street. Work has already started on natural turf nets, which would allow players to practice on pitches resembling those on the cricket field. increasing spectator capacity and more parking. As we spoke beside the pitch, Srinivasan said he'd passed a plot of land similar in size to Church Street's park earlier that day on his way to an appointment in Kerry, which had been leveled for new playing fields. The town hasn't finalized plans for it yet, but that was also the case of Morrisville a decade ago. Quote, who knows? Maybe in a year and a half, we might have a facility like Church Street Park, which is really good for more cricket. A brief article on art, specifically paintings, specifically Picasso, and specifically the North Carolina Museum of Art in Raleigh. They own their first Pablo Picasso painting, titled Seated Woman, red and yellow background, is now on display in the West Building. The 1952 portrait of Picasso's muse and lover, the French artist François Guillot, employs the cubist techniques Picasso was known for, alongside four other paintings donated to the museum that now hang in the 20th Century Art Gallery. The Picasso piece is a transformational donation, says the press release, that will significantly grow and strengthen the modern art holdings. The 19th and 20th century paintings by Picasso, Maurice de Vlaeminck, Alfred Sisley, Emil Nolde, and Kees van Dongen were originally promised to the museum in 2010 by Julian and Josie Robertson of New York City. Julian, who grew up in Salisbury and graduated from UNC Chapel Hill, developed a love of art through his wife Josie, who was an art major, says the press release. As a bequest, the paintings were given to the museum upon their deaths. Museum director Valerie Hillings said in this press release, we are grateful to the Robertson family for giving their treasured artworks to the NCMA to share with North Carolinians and all our visitors for generations to come. It's fitting that Picasso's Seated Woman, much beloved by the Robertson, enters the collection as cultural institutions worldwide are commemorating the 50th anniversary year of the artist's death. The painting isn't the only significant addition, though. Maurice de Vlaeminck's The Bridge at Poissy and Kees van Dongen's Reclining Nude serve as noteworthy examples of Fauvism. That's the first avant-garde movement that was a harbinger of abstraction, states the news release. Meanwhile, Emil Nolde's Fishing Boat Red Sky adds to the museum collection of German Expressionism, and Alfred Sisley's The Bridge at Moray on April Morning is a lovely addition to the Impressionist collection, which also includes works by Monet. And just a brief afterword there, this museum will be closed. Well, those dates are already passed. But you can check, of course, NCMA, North Carolina Museum of Art's website for their holiday hours. Looks like I have a little over 4 minutes left. We were unable to read this an hour or so ago at our Thursday noon broadcast, and it is the calendar of cultural events in Kerry. That's a small audience for us. We don't have millions like we do around the world. If you're from Tierra del Fuego listening now, you probably won't care about this. But I'm going to read just a few of them, as we usually do on that hour and a half broadcast. But this will be available through the events are listed through Saturday, December 30th, so there's not too many. First, holiday closings and modified collections for Kerry. Most staff facilities close on today and January 1st. Now, today, when I'm recording this, is December 27th. No waste collections on Christmas Day or New Year's Day, and one day delay for those collections. Next, recurring notices. RecTrack is Kerry's new easy-to-use recreation registration system for classes. You can go to Kerry.gov and KerryNC.gov and look for RecTrack account and start an account of your own. It's free. And you get to register there. And the registration for the classes opens on the 10th of January for Cary residents, and 1 week later for non-residents, classes and other programmings. The downtown Cary Park skating rink goes until January the 12th from 1 to 9 p.m., and skating and skate rentals are free. You can, again, all this, carync.gov. Realigned Morrisville Carpenter Road opens to traffic. It's eagerly awaited. Features a new bridge supporting railroad tracks just east of NC 55 Highway at Carpenter Fire Station is now open to traffic. And up till January 14th at Cocobooth Amphitheater, the North Carolina Chinese Lantern Festival has returned. I can't know how many years it's been coming here, but it's about a month-long stay in the evening. Over 40 breathtaking silk sculptures, and of course illuminated by candles or some other means. It's a fabulous color experience, I must say. Now, the few little articles, most of them are at the Cary Theater, which has its own website. I'm not even going to read those, but there are shows today, the 28th, and on the 29th, Friday, when this program's first broadcast. So I'll just read the events and not the films. In fact, there's two events. Nope, there's only one event. That is the Kwanzaa celebration is Friday, the 29th of December, and that's at 11 a.m., a free communal cultural celebration that honors African-American people and their heritage. Kids' activities, vendor market, and stage performances. And I will mention one on Saturday, December 30th at the Cary Theater, because it's not a film, well, it is, but it's a lecture and a film, Painting the Modern Garden, Monet to Matisse. It's at 11 a.m. on Saturday morning at Cary Theater. Cary Theater's tickets and information you can find online. And here comes our theme music. I'm congratulating myself for finishing almost a complete issue of Indie Week today. John Feddersen, that's my name. Be sure to enter me in ballots for excellence if anyone comes your way. We will be back next week, our regular Friday broadcast. This broadcast is available as a podcast after the Friday initial showing. That's Indie Week. We're featuring John Feddersen from the ncreadingservice.org. Thanks, everybody. Have a happy New Year's celebration.